centre at 5. Sir Bruce Forsyth, the entertainer whose career spanned more than 70 years, has died at the age of 89. His family has announced the news in the last few minutes. Claire Gregory looks back at his life in show business.
Sir Bruce Forsyth was one of the country's best-loved performers for over 70 years.
Nice to see you! To see you!
His comedy and catchphrases were a huge part of Saturday night television, starting with The Generation Game and finishing with Strictly Come Dancing. He spent 11 seasons on Strictly, waltzing his way into the record books along the way for having the longest career in TV entertainment history. And didn't he do well?
The TV veteran passed away at his home earlier, surrounded by his wife Winnie and children. It follows a battle with pneumonia. The BBC's former chairman, Lord Grade, is among those paying tribute.
He was an extraordinarily lovely, dear friend, and my heart goes out to Winnie and all the family. And to the nation who've lost their favourite and greatest ever entertainer.
The Queen has sent her condolences to the King of Spain after 14 people were killed in terror attacks in Barcelona and Cambrils. Nearly 130 people are injured, 17 of them in a critical condition. 4 people have been arrested. Police in Finland are searching for other potential suspects after a man stabbed several people in the city of Turku. Officers shot the man in the leg before arresting him. A judge has ruled that Michael Barrymore is entitled to more than nominal damages from Essex police over a wrongful arrest a decade ago. He says he wants £2.4 million for damage to his career after he was detained on suspicion of raping and murdering a man. And a record number of people visited the UK in the 3 months to June. Official figures show 10.75 million foreigners came for tourism or other reasons. That's up 8% on the same period last year. That's the latest. I'm Andy Hayes.
It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling, helping us review this week's news. It's Lib Dem councillor for Brislington West, Joss Clark. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, as usual, is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, 14 innocent civilian tourists killed in Barcelona, most of them tourists anyway, by a killer van. Also, left versus right, or is it just far left versus far right in Charlottesville in the US? Also, China is locking up young pro-democracy campaigners, including one Hong Kong MP. What are they up to in China? Plus, carried over from last week, another 9/11 scholar. This week, it's the turn of Jim Mars, author of Rule by Secrecy, amongst many other books, who sadly died last week in Fort Worth, Texas. Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots. That's all in the second hour after 6. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's 2-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 14 Celsius, occasional showers. This weekend, highs of 18. Mainly sunny tomorrow, cloudier with rain, though, on Sunday. Don't go shopping on Saturday. Get out and enjoy the sun. Next week, highs of 24, temperatures going right up actually. Plenty of sunshine with only occasional showers during next week. And next weekend, that's the 25th and 26th of August, highs of 21 Celsius, sunny spells and heavy showers. That's next weekend. That was Bristol's 2-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So, helping us review this week's news, it's Lib Dem councillor for Brislington West, Joss Clark. Hi, Joss. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Thank you.
Tell us a bit about what got you into politics, Joss.
I think my father... was a councillor in Keynsham in Baines. So, obviously, I became quite interested through my father, my ex-partner, he was a Bristol City councillor, so I don't think I had much choice really but to become engaged in politics.
Why Lib Dems though?
I think over a period of years, maybe the last 20 years or so, I've erred towards their policies. I'm fairly middle of the road probably, and I just found an affinity with their outlook.
What do you make of this sort of recent version of the Labour Party that we've got with Jeremy Corbyn in charge? It seems a bit different to the Blair version.
Totally. It's a very different world of the Labour politics and the Labour politics in Bristol. I think with Corbyn has been a real media sensation. He's surprised us all over the general election.
A lot of the media don't seem to like him, do they?
A lot of the media like him as well.
Yeah.
I mean, I think he outperformed all the expectations in the general election. Certainly.
I mean, that's certainly true. But I mean, I was quite surprised about 3 weeks before the general election, this snap general election, which was a whole bizarre thing in itself. There was all these accusations about, oh, Jeremy Corbyn's a terrorist, this kind of thing. That was coming right across BBC. Everybody saying that. And I was quite surprised he managed to bounce back from that, because nobody as a future Prime Minister wants to be called that, do they?
Of course they don't. And there's also some bits and pieces in the media, much more currently, i.e. around now, about his affiliations and his leanings internationally.
So do you think there's any truth to that, any credibility to it, or is this just a smear campaign?
I would say that he has been quite an international politician. He's always looked internationally, and he does have some affiliations with some countries and some regimes which are maybe not the mainstream for Britain.
I mean, just looking at some of the news at the moment, Conservative MP Zach Goldsmith is linking Barcelona terror attack to Labour's Momentum group. The Momentum tells the Independent it's outrageous and deeply shameful that a sitting member of Parliament would use this tragic attack to spread lies and score political points. Well, what's Zach Goldsmith saying? He's actually saying that it's partly to do with Mr. Goldsmith's, let's paraphrase here, Mr. Goldsmith's brother Ben commented on a post which suggested one of the men involved in the attack had shared an anti-Semitic video alleging a global Jewish conspiracy to take over the world, and that's, you know, he's connecting that with Momentum.
That's quite extraordinary really, isn't it? And it's probably without any foundation or any base.
Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, what do you make of the attempts to link Corbyn and Momentum and the left of the Labour Party, which I think you class yourself as...
If you remember, Zach Goldsmith accused Sadiq Khan of being a Muslim extremist on the advice of Sir Lyndon Crosby, and that didn't do him much good when he was standing against him for London Mayor. I think it's reprehensible when people just come out with knee-jerk stuff like that. I mean, I'm prepared to listen to anything, but you can't just come out with it. You know, how can you possibly start, you know, why make a political point like that after a tragedy like this? It's just shallow.
Ben Goldsmith asked, maybe he got his ideas from Labour's Momentum movement. They make for weird bedfellows, Islamism and hard leftism, but they're joined at the hip.
Well, that is basically a canard. And don't forget that Islamism, under Operation Cyclone in the 1980s, the right wing of the Conservative Party, Margaret Thatcher, set up Al-Qaeda. SAS people trained them and infiltrated them into Afghanistan.
Margaret Thatcher didn't do it herself, did she?
She did. She worked very closely with Ronald Reagan, and they had these people visiting Downing Street and visiting the White House, and these people were Al-Qaeda. They became Al-Qaeda. And of course, everybody forgets about that. They were armed and trained by our own intelligence services and security forces back in the 1980s, and we're supposed to forget all of that and suddenly say, oh, these terrible people, where have they come from? Well, they've come from exactly that milieu, and of course that milieu didn't die away. In the war in Syria, we've seen British special forces and arms and intelligence services working with jihadi groups to overthrow the government of Syria, as if they've learned nothing from the last 30 years.
Well, to be fair, Momentum have come back and said that these So just a quote, Zach Goldsmith's using the Barcelona terrorist atrocity, which killed at least 13 people, to attack momentum. The absolute state of that man, he added. Anyway, let's get away from some of this dirty stuff, the smear politics. We don't like this on this show too much, but I think when something like that happens, you have to report what people are saying, even if it does appear to be nonsense. Let's get down to earth a little bit, Joss. What's going on in Brislington for you? What are the sorts of things that are coming across your desk?
On the positive side, we've got a food festival going on in Sandy Park Road next month on the 15th. That'll be in the evening on a Friday, and that'll be down in the Repton Road car park, which we had a festival in July, which was extremely successful. We had vast numbers of people coming, and I hope that they will come for the food fest in September, which would be really nice, and we're going to do another one at Christmas as well. I'm doing a planter project with the local school in Brislington Secondary School, the Oasis Academy, and we are working with the school, the pupils in the school obviously, and the local residents to actually break down some of the barriers and have better relationships between the school children, particularly coming up and down to school in the mornings. They can be a little bit disruptive to residents, so we're doing a planter project, designing them, that the young people will design them, make them and maintain them, and we're hoping that that will soften relationships really, which is I think quite a positive project. And then we've got looming on the horizon along the A4 corridor quite a lot of high-rise, high-density developments going on. So we've got the paintworks, which is underway.
This is housing, is it?
Yes, sorry. Yeah. So it's housing. So we've got the paintworks, which have been underway, phased development. And then we've got Sovereign Housing have acquired the John Peer factory, which is opposite Arno's Vale. It's an old factory site which has been sort of empty for about 50 years or so. It's quite a well-known feature. That will be developed as housing. And then we've got along the A4, there's the old petrol station site near Totterdown Bridge, and that's going to be a high-rise development. So there is quite a lot of anxiety around the size, scale, design, the implications for the area in terms of facilities, doctors, schools, all those sorts of things.
Well, you are talking about housing developments. There has been quite a lot of talk, and I went along to a public meeting over in Bath. We don't often cover Bath stories. Apparently, you can pick this station up in Bath. If you're on the west side of the city, up on the top of the hill, you can just about pick us up over there. So I feel, I mean, also, it was a fascinating meeting. I'd just like to play some couple of an interview I did with a woman called Naila Everts, who's the... she's the chair of the local residence group at a place called Fox Hill. Now, Fox Hill used to be council housing, and then a few years ago it was privatised. Great idea, folks, to something called Curo, which is a housing association, and there are hundreds of homes there that they're now threatening to demolish. Mm. So the people are not really very happy about it, and they're absolutely packed out. I think it was St Andrew's Church just near Fox Hill. Last night to overflowing. I mean, it was probably about 200-250 seats, and they were having to turn people away. There were so many there. They were saying, well, we're expecting about 100 people, but it's obviously there's a lot of interest right across Bath in what's happening with other Curo residents and other housing association residents that are very worried about this whole idea of regeneration, because as the people at Grenfell Tower were saying, Joss, regeneration sometimes just means demolition, and you're going to have to move out. So what do you think of, you know?
I do actually know that site fairly well. I know the Fox Hill site, and I actually know the housing next to it, which the council is planning to acquire as part of this development. And I understand that the council is offering the residents in those houses a sum of money, which actually is probably not enough to buy another property in the vicinity, which causes them real challenges. And they are, you know, they've been in these properties a long time, a lot of these people, and it is really stressful.
beautiful places, and that's to say too. I mean, I just walk down the street and they look, you look at it and think, is this really council housing? These places are lovely. Bath stone built, you know, absolutely beautiful. Another thing to say is that Curo were invited along, and I would have interviewed them, of course, if they'd been at this meeting last night, to give their point of view 3 weeks ago, but then they decided they didn't want to come to the meeting. But they did send one of their directors, rather sneakily, sitting in the back of the audience, making notes on everything everyone was saying, to take back to Curo. So I don't think we're very impressed with you, Curo. And one person who definitely wasn't impressed was Naila Edwards from the Residents Association there.
I'm Naila Edwards. I live on Foxhill Estate, and I've been campaigning with a lot of my neighbours to try and stop it from demolition. Foxhill Estate, the central part of it, there's 542 homes in that central part. Curo owns 4/5 of it. They want to demolish the whole 452 and replace them with 700 homes, and in the process lose social rented homes. And those people who already own their homes, there are 95 of us who own our homes in the estate, wouldn't be able to afford to stay in the area. It was council housing that was taken over first by SOMA, then Curo. The actual planning outline consent was granted last month. They still have to go through individual planning for each area, reserve matters. So they haven't got permission yet to knock down a house yet. So we're still fighting it.
Are you surprised to see the amount of interested people here this evening? I think we reckon about 250.
I'm delighted to see how many people did turn up. It has been growing in momentum the last few months, and it's been nice the support we've been getting from all kinds of areas of Bath. Widcombe has been great for us. I think Curo shot themselves in the foot by wanting to build a cable car, because once I started joining cable car movements and saying, actually, the reason they want to do it, guys, because they're knocking down our houses, people started getting very interested.
Some people are talking about this as a sort of guinea pig situation where they're seeing what they can get away with you. Do you think that's a fair comment?
I agree, probably. Yes, I think that's what Curo will do, because if you look at Bath, it's circled by council estates with lovely big green open spaces, prime building grounds from what developers look at, yeah.
So how does it feel to be at the front line?
I'd rather be somewhere else, but I certainly don't like a bully, so I'm not going to shut up.
So that's Naila Edwards there, who's the chair of the Foxhill Residents Association. And also Ken Loach, the film director, was there speaking. And he had some quite interesting points, I thought, to make about the way that, for example, the building industry has changed over the last 30, 40 years. And so also what we were talking, I suppose, a bit about just now, which was about the phenomenon of Jeremy Corbyn in the Labour Party.
Fundamentally, there is a clash of ideology here. There are those on the right, and I include Blair's Labour Party in this, that says that only the market can answer your problems, and that the market will be the solution for your housing, for your work, for your wages, when you're sick, when you want to go, your kids to go to school, the market will solve everything. And you see, that is driving every aspect of policy. It's driving housing policy, of course, and everything else. And that what is significant, I think, now, there is a possibility of a transformed opposition to that, which we haven't had until just recently. And the big struggle, I think, is to, if we want to transform society, including how we provide houses, is that we have to transform the Labour Party to get there. And I think that process is underway, which is the first time in my lifetime, and I'm very old, it's the first time we've ever been able to say that. So I think that is extraordinary. And it's great that the film ended on a message of hope, because I think that is the hope. Because if we are to transform it, we have to take political power. It's the same in every estate where they talk about redevelopment, because what they mean is make profit. And it's very interesting that I discovered Curo is a charity. But in order to act commercially, it set up a commercial arm, wholly owned by Curo. So in a way, they've got a ghetto. Yes, they're a charity up there, but down there, it's about making money.
Yeah.
And there's a con there. Yes. You know, there's an absolute con there, as I understand it. And one other thing that occurred to me, and that's the building workers. Because while this has been going on, the conditions and the wages for building workers have been transformed away from permanent jobs back to the lump. And anybody, the older comrades here will know what the lump is. That you turn up for work, and if you're lucky, you get a job, you get a shift. And that insecurity for building workers has run alongside the increased privatisation of house building. So they attack on all fronts, and we have to defend on all fronts and reclaim public housing, publicly funded, where there's a revolving fund that constantly regenerates the housing, and we control it, and is controlled through local authorities, back as Nye Bevan planned in the 40s.
Yeah.
And that's where it works.
Well, there's some Ken Loach there giving us that old-time religion, but I think it does come round again. I think people have realised that if you don't have a public housing policy, you end up with a disastrous mess, which we've had 30 years of market-driven housing policy, and it's created a housing crisis and a property bubble which will burst, and with all the consequences for the economy.
Well, what he's pointing out there is that quite a lot of local authorities across the country who own and control and built this housing, what they've been doing is slowly letting it run down rather than ploughing the rents back into keeping places maintained in a deliberate attempt to say, well, I'm afraid we're going to, you know, in order to renovate these places, we're going to have to privatise them.
Well, I think different councils have pursued different policies, and don't forget that central government have made it very difficult for councils to pursue any rational policy. So, for example, the allowing housing associations, or forcing housing associations, to sell off their stock to existing tenants, which I find quite extraordinary. I mean, they're supposed to be independent of the government, but the government can apparently tell them what to do. But of course, that's just fuel to the fire. We need, you've got to have a public housing policy for the bottom third of the population, who will never in a free market economy have sufficient resources to get adequate housing through the market. That the Conservatives in the 1950s used to know this. They built 350,000 council houses, the Conservatives in the 1950s, far more than anybody else, and it was a good policy, and suddenly we dropped it and forgot about it.
So much of many people's problems now come down to housing, rents. Joss, do you get quite a lot as a local councillor to do with things like people being homeless or having problems with various benefits to do with housing, that kind of thing?
To be perfectly honest with you, not a huge amount. It does come occasionally. We get sort of housing problems, housing issues. I tend to have is people with problems actually coping with maintaining, looking after their council house, so actually keeping it up together, and that's because of age and frailty usually, and sometimes mental health problems.
Well, you actually work for Care and Repair as well, don't you?
I do.
Your day job. So tell us about that. What, you know, that sounds like a fascinating work that really gives you an insight into a whole area of society which is often not there on the high street and people don't see it.
Absolutely. I work for an organisation called We Care and Repair. We have a contract to deliver services in Bristol, Baines and North Somerset. We work with anybody over the age of 60 and younger, anybody who's younger with a disability. So they don't have to be on a benefit. They can, if they say that they've got a disability, that's fine, and we will help them maintain their property. So we work with majority of the time with owner occupiers. We do a bit of work with the local authority, and we will do a little bit of work with private rented as well, but the majority of our work is with owner occupiers, and that would be to maintain them. So if somebody needs a new roof on their property or new windows, they could come to us and we could either point them in the direction of a local contractor who is trusted and they can go ahead and get prices and get the work done themselves, or we can help and support them to do that. And we also have access to local charities, local authority, Wessex Loans, which is a subsidised loan from the local authority. So we've got various means of helping support people.
Also, I think probably one of the most controversial things which Marvin, the mayor, is doing, which George Ferguson managed not to do, is to charge Bristol's poorest households council tax. Now, it's difficult to know what people would think who get a decent income and have to pay some of it as council tax, about what they think about whether people with no money at all and no ability, you know, for example, you know, many of the disabled people like that, it looks as if now there's going to be everybody in the city is going to have to pay council tax. So what do you make of that, George? This is something that George stopped, but Marvin is saying, well, sorry folks, nothing I can do.
I think that the Lib Dems and the Green Party have actually, they're pursuing it as an illegal act, and they are taking it forward to see if they can stop it that way. It's a really harsh measure for these people, because finding that sum of money every year is going to be a really big ask for people.
Well, I don't know if petitions make any difference, but there is a petition, and I'll put it up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Martin, what do you make of this? I mean, we've been talking about this the last few weeks, but Marvin is holding his hands up, Marvin, our Labour mayor, and saying, well, there's nothing I can do.
Well, I think it's right that people are resisting it. I think the fundamental problem is that central government, their policy is, they basically decided that council tax was no longer going to be regarded as something that people on benefits didn't have to pay, and they've also cut the money that the local council has got. Now, you could argue that in actual fact you shouldn't try and recoup money from these people. You should recoup it from somebody else.
How are people with no income whatsoever supposed to pay whatever it is? It's around about £600-700 a year. Where are they supposed to find that money?
I mean, the council, I've got somebody I'm working with currently who is really struggling to pay their council tax, and the council tax people have actually worked with him to set up a plan so that it's going to make it possible for him to do it, but it's going to be incredibly difficult, and it's been an incredibly stressful process for that individual, and I don't wish it on anybody really, because he's having to make decisions about, you know, can I afford to heat or eat, and I've got to pay this bill.
So for people on benefits, Martin, or on virtually no income, they're going to have to find an extra, well, say something like £60-70 a month, maybe, you know, from nowhere.
Well, one of the effects of that, of course, is it means that people, it becomes very, when you had to pay pension tax when you got a job, that was a disincentive to get a job. So you could argue that this will take that away. But of course, the rates system, which they still have in Northern Ireland, is a much better way of funding local government.
It's a regressive tax, isn't it?
It is, because you're chasing the whole idea of council tax is son of poll tax, and the whole idea was that the poor should have to pay into the local authority's budget so that they wouldn't vote for more stuff for the poor. That was the basic idea.
But and of course, people are having to pay, I think they say it's something like 7.5% of the property's value is what they use to gauge the council tax. But of course, the people who are living in many of these properties don't actually own that property.
Indeed.
So
it's
been transferred, a tax that's been transferred from the landlord onto the occupier.
Well, that's right, and of course the rate system is much more effective, and they didn't abolish it in Northern Ireland because they knew if they tried to do it, it would be throwing petrol on the bonfire, and that means that local authorities in Northern Ireland are much better funded with much more scope, and not just because they've been given a massive bribe by Theresa May.
Well, there is a consultation at the moment about this. If you want to make your views felt, I'll put a link up on our show page, thisweek.org.uk. And there'll be a decision made in October by the Cabinet, so we'll try and keep a track on that particular story. Also, There's also another one, which is this announcement last week. It's not really this week's story, last week, but there's been a lot of reaction this week to it, that Metrobus is going to cost us even more. The Mayor Marvin Rees saying it's not my fault, it's going up, and also Marvin saying that if he was there, he wouldn't have started the Metro Bus scheme in the first place. So there are a lot of people saying, Joss, that this isn't actually really going to... it's not going to save a lot of congestion. It's not going to stop a lot of congestion. What's it for, this Metro Bus thing?
Well, it was central government funding, wasn't it, that came our way. But in terms of Brislington West, which where I'm the councillor and I live... the Metro Bus is not going to make a jot of difference to my life or any of my residents' lives, because it's just too far across the city.
And it's really congested up there as well, isn't it? The A4.
The A4 is really poor. It's going to be very diplomatic.
Maybe they've spent maybe a hundredth of what they're spending on Metro Bus on just widening the road a bit.
The other thing is, I mean, I what we need to do is we need to be quite radical in this city and have a really good look at the traffic system, because the city's growing, it's going to grow, we all know that. The A4, just for an example, is a very busy road. We need to grasp the nettle of public transport. The Metro Bus is fine. I mean, I think it's been an extraordinarily costly scheme, ridiculous in a way, building these bridges for just one bus. I don't get it. And if we'd been able to plough that money into our public transport system across the city, then we could have all benefited. And the reason that people don't use buses is because they don't go to the places they want to go to. They're not regular enough, they're not reliable enough, and they're not cheap enough. And if we could grasp that and actually get our heads around it as a city, it's going to be difficult, but we're going to have to do it one day.
But it's only an extra 10 million, Martin. That's not much, is it?
Well, I think the problem is it's path dependency. Once you've actually started doing this and you've spent a long time doing it, you can't really cancel it at this stage. Well, otherwise, you've wasted all of the resources you've committed to.
This seems to happen in almost all these projects, doesn't it? Overrun. HS2, we've just... latest figures that's doubled from what it was originally. Now, it's apparently going to cost £111 billion. I mean, obviously, that's not going to help people here in Bristol either, because it's not going to be coming in this direction. But it just seems like these big companies that build these projects are taking the mickey.
Well, it's not just the companies. The companies, it's because we've not had a proper transport policy, either as a city or a country, for over 30 years. I mean, do you remember when John Prescott was supposed to be, you know, coordinating transport policy? Whatever happened to that? It was an aspiration, and then nothing was done. And... you know, if you carry on doing silly stuff for years and years and years, eventually you end up in a cul-de-sac and a traffic jam, don't you?
One of the headlines yesterday, the government is focusing, this is in the Bristol Post again, on the lowest unemployment since 1975. That's Dan Bloom and Christian Davis, Martin, in the Bristol Post.
It's still over 1 million, and I'm old enough to remember when unemployment went over 1 million in 1973, and the headlines on the newspapers was very much, you know, 1 million unemployed, what will happen now, blah, 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 blah. We now talk about it as a positive thing, only 1.5 million unemployed. And that just shows how our aspirations have been ground down, as I said earlier, by years and years and years of stupid stuff.
The Department for Work and Pensions have also made it much more difficult to claim unemployment benefit, haven't they? So a lot of people have just given up one way or another. They've gone on to being self-employed.
And lots of people in work are not really in full-time work anyway. They're just off the books.
I was looking at some figures the other day. The tens of thousands of people on ridiculously tiny monthly wages from being so-called unemployed, doing things like selling bits and pieces that they find around scrap on eBay. These kinds of things, Joss, don't sound to me like real jobs. And of course, but it all helps to reduce the unemployed figures.
Absolutely. I mean, it's massaging the figures, isn't it? These zero-hour contracts. I mean, how you can run a household, and it must be incredibly difficult. And it just means that you're precluded from claiming benefits. It just makes life very, very hard for people. I mean, we're coming back to the council tax issue. I mean, if you're on a zero-hour contract and you're getting meagre pickings in terms of hours and salary, then it's really tough times.
Also, more evidence this week, if you can call it that, that we might have Jacob Rees-Mogg taking over as the Prime Minister. Rees-Mogg is your British Trump, Spanish media say. Jacob is a mini Donald Trump. Jacob Rees-Mogg's soaring popularity has caught soaring popularity. I do love these, honestly. Has caught the world's attention. This is the Daily Express, of course. And by standing out as an opponent of the political elite, if you could call him that, the North Somerset MP has drawn comparisons with US President Donald Trump, Martin, in the Spanish press.
Political elite. I mean,
an opponent of the political elite.
Jacob Rees-Mogg is worth squillions, and his inherited wealth from several generations back. I mean, his family have been running North Somerset for donkey's years, and the idea that this is some kind of rebel against the elite is rather laughable. But of course, he's a much politer person than Donald Trump, who has a bit of a potty mouth.
What about, it's also another one, saviour of the Tory party or reactionary poison? Will Jacob Rees run for Tory leader? And what, Rees-Mogg run for Tory leader? And what should he do as Prime Minister? This is The Independent. Apparently he's admired, Joss, by young right-wingers, but one gay former Conservative MP declared him a reactionary poison.
Wow. We're kind of laughing when you introduce this topic. I think it's... watching Rees-Mogg has been very interesting over the past couple of months, really. He, in my view, he seems to be sort of sneaking in there under the radar, and he's positioning himself quite nicely. And I think that he is a serious contender, personally. I can't see Boris Johnson getting it, and I can see that Rees-Mogg... he's very affable. He presents well. He's on a lot of the programmes at the moment. He seems to be raising his profile.
But this is how the mainstream press prepare us for a new leader, isn't it? They just make sure he's on all the time.
Yeah, I mean, obviously clutching the new baby.
What do you think about the comparison with Boris, Martin?
Well, he's a safer pair of hands than Boris Johnson. Let's put it that way. I think whoever the Tories choose to be the leader, they've got a problem. I mean, Rees-Mogg is very much on the hard right Brexit wing of his party. He doesn't believe in abortion. He doesn't believe in gay rights. He's got no social liberal bone in his body. And they're going to find that there's a rebellion on their own. You know, some Tories aren't going to like that. So even if he becomes the Prime Minister, he's then got a problem that he may not have a majority in the House of Commons. And that may be a problem for whoever is the Tory leader.
Well, he has been on this programme in the past. Maybe we should dig out some quotes from him from those and see if we can hold him to them. I have put several requests in for him to come on, even on the phone, but he's not been able to do our programme because maybe he'll get a bit of a tough time here, Martin, from you particularly.
Well, we had quite a good debate some years ago, didn't we?
Allegations about this letter that he could be using to help him get into power.
Well,
alleged letter, sorry.
Well, we covered this last week, and if people are interested, that if they go to our show page, they will see there's a whole article by Peter Eyre about the Rees-Moggs and their links with the Braden Camp, who is an arms dealer from South Africa who lives in the constituency. And
so this is one of the things people don't necessarily know about about Somerset.
That's right.
Is that there are quite a lot of these right-wing South Africans and
Rhodesians. Well, they're mostly Rhodesians. There's little Rhodesia up there, and they're all married into the
like
local squirearchy,
for example.
Yeah.
Anyway, so what is this letter supposed to be about?
It's a long story, and I'm getting inside information about it, so I'll have to be very brief because we do cover this quite frequently.
Go for it.
My informant tells me that he suspects that a letter is in the possession of Jacob Rees-Mogg, which is a letter that was written by Tony Blair to Dan Norris, who, when he was MP for Radstock, saying to Dan Norris, or basically reassuring Dan Norris, that the so-called weapons of mass destruction in Iraq were not missing NATO warheads, because there are missing NATO warheads, two lots, one lot from South Africa, one lot which fell in the sea off Somalia and were supposedly rescued by Billy Reutenbach and Braden Camp back in that era, and that Rees-Mogg did a deal with Dan Norris about this letter. Now,
what you're suggesting is that possibly, you know, that some money may have changed hands, and this letter may have changed hands.
That's right. But I mean, we've only got one source for this, and it's essentially gossip.
That's
all we can
say.
Yeah.
It may have been 50p.
But I mean, the point is that the Rees-Moggs do have very strong links with Sir Kenneth Warren, who used to be the main funding chap for the Tory party, and Warren and Braden Camp have a relationship going back a long way, and the part of the allegations are to do with South Africa's nuclear weapons, which were supposedly dismantled at the beginning of the 1990s, but were in fact sold on the black market through Astra Holdings, which is set up by Stephen Koch, who's a former MI6 officer, and there was corruption associated with this, some of it to the Tory party, some of it to individuals, and that these then were lost, went missing. And one of the places they may have turned up with in is North Korea. But Braden Kampf is the key to all of this, who is a South African arms dealer, and he's based in the constituency along with Reutenbach. Both were in the SAS in Rhodesia in the 1980s.
And this is a sort of gossip you might hear circulating around the pub in Kilmersdown. But anyway, Martin, at the end of the day, this is the sort of thing that the Tory party, if there's truth to it, they would really want to keep the lid on it, wouldn't they?
They would. I mean, the suggestion is Doug Hoyle, the Labour MP, made a question in the House of Commons about this some years ago, because in the 1992 election, the Tories had £17 million in one donation, which we are directed to believe came from this illegal nuclear weapons deal. And it's certainly a lot of money, and they still haven't adequately explained where it came from.
OK, well, we'll not quite leave it at that, because there has been lots and lots of talk about Jacob Rees-Mogg, and by Jacob Rees-Mogg. Obviously, you know, it'd be interesting to see if he does become Prime Minister, what with Theresa May having really no credibility whatsoever after her disastrous general election. Someone's got to take over, haven't they? And this is something I discovered on Facebook, which is a poet. He's, I think, a Labour Party supporter or something, but anyway, he's written this, and it's called Mogmentum.
I am charmed to be, I must confess, the latest darling of the right-wing press. Express and Mail and BBC seem terribly impressed with me and assure me I will get your vote. My knife is at Theresa's throat. My seat is Northwest Somerset, but I know I can be greater yet. At Eton and at Trinity, I came to know what I could be, with tailored suit and eyes like glass, the epitome of the ruling class. My people made their wealth from coal, though we did not toil in a deep, dark hole, and I myself was a city gent who toiled in asset management. Yet truly I stand for the working man. I feel your pain, I understand. Your welfare is my every thought as I walk my grounds at Gournay Court. I ardently support our troops at luncheons held by right-wing groups, and the sparkling wit of my Twitter feed reeks of care for those in need. And I will champion liberty, just not for gays and refugees. I raise the flag with tear-filled eyes for all we have yet to privatise, and yearn to build a better land for those within my income band. I, the Right Honourable J. Rees-Mogg, will pledge my life to lift the fog that threatens again our once great nation. Socialism, peace, and nationalisation. Against these ills I raise my sword to defend the chairmen of the board. So forth, Mogmentum, seize the day, for I alone can lead the way.
That's a poem there by Ian Jenkins. I'll put a link to his stuff, because he does actually quite a lot of rather good poetry, I think. Anyway, I enjoyed it, about various things that are going on in politics. The sort of stuff we used to get from people like Rory Bremner, but they don't seem to even... this. I was very disappointed. I don't know what you make of this, Joss, but in the general election, usually we used to get these great Rory Bremner shows. As soon as the polls close at 10 o'clock, all the laws change about what you can and can't say on the broadcast media. And so we used to get a Rory Bremner show, or at least something. Nowadays, Rory Bremner's doing a performance to a live audience in Huddersfield, but he's never on the TV. I wonder why that is.
I went and saw him when he came to Bristol just before the election, actually, and he was very, very good. He was very entertaining, particularly Trump, who was excellent on. Well, I mean, Trump's very good. He's just
Every day,
you know, there's something with that man. Yeah, he was good, and it's a shame. I think that Dead Ringers on Radio 4 was pretty good around the election, actually. I thought this year their show was more political than usual, and it was good quality.
You were giving me a few tips as well as good places to pick up political news from Westminster and stuff. So do you want to just share those with us now?
My two top, well, the three top programmes, actually, I would pick up the Westminster Hour, which is Radio 4, 10 o'clock on Sunday night. It's very it's quite a chatty, informal, relaxed programme. They usually have good guests. Rees-Mogg is on there by chance quite regularly, and that's an hour, and that's a good listen. There's also a programme which I pick up on a podcast, which is called Talking Politics, with a guy called David Runciman. Fabulous. I love him so much. He's so good, so interesting. And that again is quite conversational, talk about national and international politics and what's not to like about The Economist. I love The Economist.
Well, I'll tell you what's not to like about it, and that is that they don't have bylines, which really irritates me, because you get an article, but it doesn't actually say who's written it, which is a bit sneaky, really. You know, and certainly for if you want to follow up with an individual journalist, hang on, I can add something to this, or you've got this wrong or whatever, you can't do it.
But you can, I don't know whether you can pick up The Economist Radio as a podcast, and that they have three... shows a week, so that's the week coming up. So that Anne McElvoy is on there a lot, and that's really good. And they do Babbage, which is science, which is obviously less politics, but that's a very good podcast.
Well, we'll put links up to all of those, even though The Economist most definitely is our competition. I say, Martin, what do you read The Economist as an economist yourself?
I have to admit, I've got the same prejudices about The Economist as you've got, which is A, they don't have bylines, and the other thing, of course, is there is an economist view, which is very much a neoliberal view. And I tend not to share that view, so I tend to look at other things which aren't like that at all. That would be, you know, there's what you might call confirmation bias, isn't it, really?
No, we're talking about a bit of technology there, but also something you flagged up to me, Martin, just after the show last week, which I think would be nice, interesting to talk about, is Google. Because Google have a new algorithm, which they announced back in April, but which was only implemented a couple of weeks ago, which keeps all except mainstream press pretty much off the first page of your search. Now, I was just earlier on looking for Global Research, for example, which is a site I use quite a lot from Canada, putting Global Research into Google, and it's not there anymore as it used to be. So there's been big changes in Google over the last few weeks. Have you noticed this, Martin?
I have, yeah. I mean, and it's been picked up by various more radical websites who've noticed that their traffic has absolutely crashed as a result of this new algo. And of course, Google's unique selling proposition used to be that if you put in a search term, the thing, you know, the most hits will be the top of the list. But they've now decided, as a result of discussions with the powers that be about fake news, etc., that they're going to basically put the first page of their search is going to be the stuff that's already been vetted by the established powers that be. And of course, that's actually a complete defiance of what the internet's supposed to be about. And ultimately, the way to punish Google, of course, is people to use other engines like Yandex and take the money off them.
Another one I would say is, I actually did a bit of a test last week, is DuckDuckGo is another one you can use. Another one is WebCrawler, which actually started in the early 1990s. I can remember it was one of the first ever search engines I used when the internet began in the mid-1990s, when I first got onto the internet. Anyway, Google seems to have quite a lot of power these days, Joss, and it looks from this... I'm going to play a clip for a minute from somebody from the World Socialist website who says that they've had a massive decrease in the number of people actually coming to visit their site since the last 2 weeks, since this new algorithm was used to keep alternative news off the first page of the Google search. I wonder what you whether you've noticed anything, and whether
I haven't.
What do you think of the power of Google nowadays? Well, it's quite. Most people just. It's like Hoovers, isn't it? You know, they used to talk about Hoovers instead of vacuum cleaners. Now it's Google instead of search.
Well, yeah, I mean, Google is extraordinarily powerful. I think this is probably as a result of the fake news and people being much more sensitive these days about propaganda, as we would call it in the past, I suppose. Is it a good thing that this is happening? Probably not. Is it suppressing certain sites? Yes, of course it's going to.
One of them they are suppressing, because I got an email from the chap a couple of days ago, is something called Hang the Bankers, which has charted 48 suspicious banking deaths, and he's got links to all of the mainstream press articles about all of these different deaths. And a whole sort of background on many of the individuals that have died in banking over the last couple of years. JP Morgan, many of them very senior people in the banking world. He's found that he has now disappeared completely, Martin, off of the Google rankings, where he used to be the first if you were looking for dead bankers.
Yeah, well, we need to, obviously the response of the alternative news movement, if you want to call it that. We've got to alert people to what's going on here. We've got to try and use other search engines if necessary. People who want to go to the World Socialist website can always go there. What's happening is that the links to people who've got a general interest in politics don't link to their articles anymore because of the way they've jigged the algorithm.
So people are used to going to Google to find stuff that they found before, and then you're finding it's gone because it's further down the search.
Yeah, well, ultimately, of course, we might have to make the case that these search engines should be viewed as a public utility and regulate them as we regulate things like broadcast media, like we're regulated by Ofcom here.
Anyway, let's have a listen now to a chap called Andre Damon, and he's from something called the World Socialist Website. Here he is speaking on Russia Today.
Yes, and among a whole series of left-wing, progressive, and anti-war websites, we have found, using our research based on the Amazon Alexa search tool and ratings tool, that the rankings and traffic of many left-wing websites have plummeted after Google implemented a new search algorithm, which was announced in that blog post you referenced on April 25th. And that had a tremendous impact on the amount of traffic, according to a number of websites that we've spoken to, coming from Google to progressive websites and left-wing websites. And yes, the World Socialist website was certainly affected. We think that Google has no business in deciding what political viewpoints can and cannot be presented to users. If a user searches any topic on a political question, he or she should have a wide range of viewpoints that are presented to them. But the vision that was outlined in the April 25th document explaining the changes to Google's algorithm is something completely different. It envisions Google becoming a censorship engine rather than a search engine, in which it has a whole series of internal guidelines with evaluators, which are a little more effectively than censors, who decide what is real and what is fake, what news should be presented and what news should not be presented. And the effect is that people's opinions, if they don't line up with the interests of Google, which is one of the most politically connected corporations on the planet, having given more in lobbying donations over the recent period than any other corporation. If they don't line up with the interests of Google, if they don't line up with the interests of the government, if they don't line up with the interests of the military and intelligence establishment, they will be censored. And the vision outlined in that document is entirely consistent with the statistics that we've seen. Anyone who follows the news will notice that international tensions and conflicts are heating up, not just between the United States and Russia, but between the United States and North Korea, China. At any time there's a increase in international tensions and the threat of war, the freedom of speech is the first thing to go. And we think that the attack on democratic rights, in which Google is aiding and abetting, is intimately bound up with the drive to war and the threat of dictatorship in the United States.
The trouble with all of this is that the news that we get on the mainstream press, Martin, as we'll be sort of building up to our 16th anniversary of September the 11th, isn't always the truth. And in fact, everyone remembers the lies we were told for months about Saddam Hussein and his weapons of mass destruction, which actually many alternative sites, and in fact something like 2 million people went to London saying they didn't believe it. But so the mainstream press is not squeaky clean, is it?
No, and of course what's happening now is they're reacting to the success of alternative ways of getting information. I mean, what used to be the internet was that it was based upon numbers of hits that a site had got. It was objective. The people that got the most hits were at the top of the list. Now, once you fiddle with that, then you've changed the whole basis on which the internet operates. And of course, they're trying to basically clamp down on the internet because the mainstream media is pretty controlled either by corporations or by governments. And the internet was an alternative mechanism for getting information. Obviously, governments like the Chinese government try to control the internet, and of course, tech-savvy kids can always go around this. But people need to know that search engines aren't proper search engines, otherwise they're going to be deluded about it, aren't they?
Joss, let me give you a final word on this. Does it matter?
Does it matter? It's not an area that I know a huge amount, and obviously my colleague sitting to my left knows a whole lot more than I do about it. It's quite a new area for me. It's not great. It doesn't strike me as it's indicative of the world that we are in currently, and partly this is as a result of dear Trump making us much more sensitive and much more cynical.
Okay. Also, LearnDirect has been branded inadequate in Ofsted report. It's tried to suppress UK's largest provider of adult training and apprenticeships, has failed in a High Court bid to quash the report. Well, things have been moving quite fast on LearnDirect. It seems to be in a bit of a mess, Martin.
Well, I mean, I don't know very much about what's happened with them. I have had dealings with them in the past. It's very hard for me to comment because I don't really know the substance of what the allegations are.
Do you know? Have you been following this one, Joss?
No.
So I'll just read a little bit out from this Guardian article. UK's largest provider of adult training and apprenticeships has been branded inadequate in a damning inspection by Education Watchdog Ofsted, and which it went to court to try and suppress it. It's got 73,000 trainees on its apprenticeships and training programmes. But the real allegation here is, hang on, this is a government report which has been done on the efficiency of, or otherwise, of LearnDirect, and they don't want it published.
Well, I have to say that Ofsted are not my favourite people. I know many teachers, and my family are all teachers, and Ofsted is regarded with ill-disguised contempt. So they've got a credibility problem, never mind LearnDirect.
But they're still winning government contracts despite this report, Joss.
Yeah, I mean, obviously all needs looking into.
Well, I think we're nearly there, actually. It's probably going to be time for the Murdoch News at 6 in a minute. Well, I'm sure it is, in fact. So thanks very much to our guest, who was Lib Dem councillor for Bridlington West, Joss Clark. Also, you can join us after the news as we do our best to keep ahead of the curve. We'll be looking at the Barcelona attacks, plus also Charlottesville, and we'll have Jim Miles, who died last week, talking about 9/11 after the news.
This is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.